From two beautifully scenic and historic locations, the Hudson Valley, New York, and Willow, Alaska, this is The Side Vibe, brought to you by Dog Works Radio. Your hosts are author, journalist, and photographer, the Five Sides mom, Dorothy Wills Raftery, and Dog Works Radio executive producer, canine behaviorist, trainer, and lead musher of Team Aneke, Robert Forto. The Side Vibe is all about the magnificent breed of the Siberian Husky. From training to grooming, and for those who show and breed, from parenting to playing and rescuing huskies in need, whether mushing over snow-covered trails or lounging on tropical shores, even for Hollywood sides on the big silver screen and so very much more. If it's about a Siberian Husky, we'll chat about it here.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, hosting from Willow, Alaska. And before we start, I just want to apologize for the bad connection today. I have to call in on my phone. We're losing internet up and back because of the fires up here. With that, I want to introduce our host today. Her name is Dorothy Wills Raftery. Dorothy, how's it going?
Hi, Robert. It's going well here, and I just want to say happy Father's Day to you and to all the dads out there, whether you have human children or furry children or both, and we hope that everyone has a wonderful day. And, Robert, I know you have a lot to be thankful for today with your family and dogs all safe so far from those fires going on up there in Willow, Alaska. And I know you did have to evacuate your dogs to a friend's property for a while, but I understand they're back home now. But some of your mushing friends were not so lucky and did lose their homes, and it's all very scary. And I wonder if you'd just take a few minutes and tell us about the status of the fires and how you and your neighbors are doing, and how did you evacuate 50 dogs?
Well, last Sunday at about 1 o'clock, a major forest fire started up here from some crazy idiot that was shooting off fireworks during a burn ban, and it quickly spread over thousands of acres. And Willow is a huge mushing community, as most people know, and it was right in the heart of where quite a few mushers live, and one of them in particular that probably everybody knows that follows mushing is Dee Dee Genro. She lost her home in the fire, as well as six other Iditarod and mid-distance mushers here in the area. So it's a real troubling time up here in Willow, but the community response has been great. There are fundraisers going on all over the world to help these guys. I've never seen anything like it. We are a very strong community, and we want to send a shout-out to everybody out there that's helped us out.
Now, I know a lot of our listeners, too, have been commenting to me that they're keeping you and your family and neighbors all in their thoughts and prayers. And is there a way that folks can help out those in need there if they want to?
Yes, they can follow or head on over to the Willow Dog Mushers Association Facebook page, and we can put a link on this show page if you like. And they're doing a fundraiser along with the Northwest Sled Dog Association. I believe you might know her. Her name is Connie Starr. She is a musher out in Washington, and she's setting up a fundraiser over there, and people are coming together and doing great things. With us, we were pretty far from the fire, but we had to take those precautions. You know, when you have 30-odd dogs in the yard, you want to make sure that you can get them out pretty quickly, because when they come knocking on your door and say you have to go, you usually only have about 30 minutes. So we packed up and moved everybody and all the dogs down to a friend's house about 20 miles away, and they were very comfortable. They were lounging on the lake and playing with the ducks.
I did see the picture. It was very heartwarming to see that and knowing that they were safe. And I noticed you also posted that you have an evacuation plan that you have in place. Can you just tell us a little bit about what that is and how you do it?
Yes, just starting this spring, our borough, which is what we call our counties up here, requires all mushers to have an evacuation plan approved by the borough. And with that, you have to have a location where you're going, how long it's going to take you to get there, and the supplies you're going to take. And we have that hanging up in our kennel building just in case for things like this. And since we just got our kennel license renewed just last month in May, we were very versed in what we were supposed to do. So we had everything packed up and ready to go, and we were out of here in less than an hour. It did take five trucks of people moving crates of dogs and getting everything together. And we decided to go at 1 a.m., and we were out of here by 2:15.
Wow. Well, just please stay safe and know that we are all thinking of you out here.
Well, thank you very much, and I'll definitely pass that along. So what's happening today here on the Side Vibe?
Well, today our guest is Jackie Roach, and she is the president and founder of the Tasia Blue Siberian Husky and Malamute Rescue, and that's based out of Omaha, Nebraska. Jackie tells us that she met her husband 11 years ago, and, quote, being older and wiser, I wanted to let him know up front what my likes and dislikes and idiosyncrasies were so that there were no surprises down the road. I don't like dogs. I have no use for them, end quote. She says she didn't stop there either. She went on to proclaim that, quote, I don't like how they lick me, jump on me, their personalities are so predictable, I will never have a dog, so if you want a relationship with me, you should know that. But she said, just as the words were leaving her lips, she remembered thinking that it sounded so closed-minded, so she says that she had opened the door just a bit and finished with, but if I did, it would have to be a Siberian Husky. Fast forward 4 months after they were married, and guess what? That's right, they welcomed in their first Siberian Husky. Another 18 months later, they added a second Husky, and she recalls how she thought at the time that having two Siberian Huskies was nothing short of crazy. Jackie started volunteering at a local shelter as an adoption counselor. It was there that she met Tasia Blue, the namesake of her future rescue, who, at the age of 9 years old, was scheduled to be euthanized. Jackie says she agreed to adopt her even before telling her husband about her. He, of course, agreed, and then there were three Huskies in the Roach household. There goes the Husky potato chip theory that we all are quite familiar with. Tasia Blue had mega esophagus, a high prey drive, and a strong dislike for their youngest. Jackie remarks that their years of bliss went out the window when they added Tasia, a third female, to the mix. She says she learned how not to break up a dog fight and kept them separated with crates and gates. Lots of lessons learned, however, consults from trainers and behaviorists left her with the phone recommendation to have Tasia put to sleep, as the situation will probably, quote, never get better, they told her. Jackie refused the ridiculous advice, and she contacted Paige from Tales of the Tundra Siberian Husky Rescue, whom Jackie calls a saint, as Paige spent hours on the phone with her talking to her about how to manage the behavioral issues. Within months, Jackie happily reports that they had relative harmony with the Husky, the so-called experts at the time suggested there was no hope for. Since then, the Roaches have added Blue, a woolly Siberian from our local shelter, who I might add won an award in one of our Five Sibes previous photo contests. And she also has Mackie, a Husky Malamute mix, and an Alaskan Malamute named Betty, who they adopted from Lewis and Clark Humane Society in Helena, Montana. Betty was one of the 200 Malamutes that were seized in a cruelty raid case about 4 years ago. Tasia Blue is a nonprofit organization and operates within about a three-hour radius of Omaha, Nebraska, which includes Kansas City, Des Moines, Iowa, Central Nebraska, and the Sioux City, Iowa, and Sioux Falls, South Dakota areas. While there is no actual facility, they have an excellent foster family care system in place for the Huskies and Malamutes they rescue. Tasia Blue became an official rescue 5 years ago this month, and in October we'll celebrate the actual anniversary when they had their first saved dog with one volunteer and one rescue family. The rescue has saved 47 Huskies in their first year of operation and have estimated about 100 Huskies and Malamutes saved per year since, including 58 Huskies and Malamutes saved to date so far in 2015, and it's just June. On an average of a life saved every 3.5 days, and I find that pretty amazing. Jackie credits their amazing, super smart group of volunteers for their success in helping Siberian Huskies and Malamutes in need. Jackie says, rescuing Tasia Blue has been the single most rewarding thing I've done. She inspires me to do more, to make a better world for animals. She helped me find my purpose and my passion. Jackie, welcome to the Side Vibe.
Thank you, Dorothy.
So I'd say you definitely got bit by the husky bug, which I know is so happy, so easy to happen, isn't it?
It absolutely is.
Now, let's start with Tasia Blue, of course. Tell us about when you first met her. What caught her? What about her caught your eye and your heart and, you know, made you realize that you knew she needed to be part of your family?
Well, it was actually an interesting experience. I was walking through the back kennels in our local Humane Society, and there's hundreds and hundreds of these kennels where stray dogs were kept or dogs waiting for surgery before they're put into adopt. And I was just walking through the rows and rows and rows of kennels, looking at all the dogs, and then I saw her eyes. There was one brown, one blue, and they just seemed to be pleading with me to stop. So I did, and I took a look at her paperwork, and I was interested to see when she would be ready to be brought into the adoption kennels. And then I saw in a red Sharpie the letters PTS, and that means put to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And so the reason cited was medical. She had had a couple seizures, and they'd noticed that she'd been vomiting. So I found a vet on staff, and I told the vet that I was going to take her home and to not euthanize her. And essentially, that's what I did.
Wow. Now, was it hard to convince your husband to bring in a third husky?
We had talked about it and, you know, thought that that would be a ridiculous thing to do. And this was kind of funny because I'd committed to taking her, but I still had to work my shift. as an adoption counselor. And so the stress of this, by the time I left for home that day, I know I just, my blood pressure had to have been through the roof, and I had just really worked myself up into this ball of stress, which reads all over my face. And so I walked in the front door, and my husband met me at the door, and I met him with a, "We need to talk." So now I'm stressing him. I suggested, "Let's go get a beer. Let's go outside and talk." So now the stress had transferred to him, and he thought, what is going to come out of her mouth? And finally, I was able to say, "There's this dog." Well, that was better than whatever he thought I was going to say. And so he was relieved, and he said, "Of course." And we went up to the shelter and met her and made plans to bring her home.
That's wonderful. And, you know, and here we are on Father's Day, so we definitely have to give a nod out to your husband. I know even here, you know, I do a lot with the dogs, but my husband's quiet behind the scenes as well. And that's how I wound up with five. I actually tell him that because every now and then we talk about how crazy it is. And I look at him and say, "Well, you know, it's really your fault we have five. It actually is on you, not me." Because I thought I couldn't say no. So we definitely have to give your husband major props for, you know, backing up and being right there with you through all this.
He does.
Tasia had a medical problem called mega esophagus. Can you talk about what that is and what type of special needs Tay had as a result of it?
Yeah, you know, and it took a long time to diagnose it. Mega esophagus, or mega E, is essentially an enlarged esophagus. So if you think about the plumbing in your kitchen sink, imagine if those pipes were made out of like a balloon or a soft material. So it would stretch as it fills. So in a dog, food and water can pocket in that esophagus and not get where it's needed. And at some point, the dog's going to regurgitate that back up. So there's a lot of risks involved, aspiration, pneumonia, absorption of nutrients, irritation of the esophagus and all that. And it's really sad because either it goes undiagnosed, oftentimes it goes undiagnosed, and a lot of times there's so little known about it, and there is no cure for it. And a lot of times, you know, veterinarians will suggest euthanasia, but we're learning that it can be managed. It's not easy. You know, Tayshia initially was regurgitating several times a day, as many as 20 times a day. We'd follow around with a squeegee and a dust mop, or a dustpan. But eventually we learned how to feed her, standing her vertically on her back legs, you know, like a human would stand, and used gravity to get the food down. And we'd leave her standing vertically for, you know, 15, 20 minutes. And, it, you know, it took a little time and research and trial and error and a lot of patience and a lot of sense of humor. But, you know, she really lived a pretty happy, healthy rest of her life.
You know, just to elaborate a little bit more on the standing vertical, there's a special chair they make for that. Is that right? That helps them? Can you just talk about that a little bit? Because there might be, you know, listeners who aren't even aware that this type of tool exists for them.
Yes, it's amazing. It's called a Bailey chair. And it was a chair that someone who had a dog, I believe it was a golden retriever, German shepherd, I don't remember, but they built this chair for their dog to stand up in, and it helps give them something to lean on and keep them relatively confined, and so it makes it a lot easier when you're doing the feeding. If you just Google Bailey chair online, you can find directions how to make one, and I know there's other companies out there that will make them and ship them.
And also, just to bring a little bit more awareness to Mega E, is there a specific diet that Tay had to be on?
You know, Tayshia was pretty lucky. We were able to feed her pretty regular kibble with water mixed into the kibble. My Alaskan Malamute, Betty, also has megaesophagus. That was the reason I adopted her. And her diet, we've found, needs to be a little bit more of a shake-like consistency. We use a dehydrated raw with quinoa food and add some raw goat's milk and water to that and put that in the blender, so it's kind of like a shake.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what she eats, and that seems to work best for her.
Now, how common of a condition is that with, well, I guess not just with northern breed dogs, but how common of a condition is it?
Well, it's not very common, but I say that with an asterisk because I think that maybe perhaps the condition goes undiagnosed,
mm-hmm.
and dogs potentially have it without ever realizing that they do. I'd say I was lucky. Tayshia Blue and Betty both have a relatively manageable case of megaesophagus, and you know, I'm involved in groups on social media that you know, families go through bouts of aspiration pneumonia and a lot worse things than I've been through.
Well, it's good to hear that there are support groups out there too, so listeners know that there's a place to go to, and that, you know, again, this is something where they're not alone doing this, and there are tools and people in place to help guide them, and not to be afraid to adopt one with it, you know, as you have with both of them. Jackie, backing up a little bit, you've said how sickened you were by the advice of the so-called professionals who were telling you what to do with Tayshia Blue to have her euthanized. And that's how you started thinking about starting a rescue and why you named it after her. Can you tell us a little bit about those early days of starting the rescue?
Sure. You know, it was very frustrating because Tayshia and my youngest dog, Jambalaya, were fighting. And that's when I started seeking help from others. And I was hearing advice from trainers to just euthanize Tayshia, and I thought that was just such ridiculous advice when it could be managed. I just needed somebody to teach me. But I was, you know, I was pretty naive in the beginning because I'm kind of a numbers person, so I kind of modeled out a plan where I would pull dogs from our local humane society that they were not able to adopt out. Maybe the older ones or the ones that were maybe challenging for the shelter to have. And based on those numbers, I estimated that we might save 8 to 10 dogs a year. And what I didn't account for were all the area shelters and all the communities outside of Omaha, Nebraska that didn't have that large of a facility or didn't have a facility like the one we have here in town. And so I just really never understood what the need was, you know, but I'm really proud of how we went about doing it. We treat it as a business. We do strategic planning. We monitor metrics to make sure we're maximizing the number of dogs that we save and make sure that we have the resources to pay for those dogs that come in. You know, we don't treat it as a hobby. It's a serious business. We're in the business of saving lives, and I think that's really guided us throughout. From the beginning, we established guiding principles, which kind of keep us grounded. We have a set of core values that we follow, but all leading back to working and educating people. And I guess that kind of goes back to my frustration when I adopted Tayshia was that, you know, the resources and the education wasn't there. And so clearly there was a need, and so that guides us with everything that we do.
Now, you had mentioned before you had Siberian Huskies that you did read about the breed, didn't think any of their personality traits, I think we'll call them, applied to you. It sounds like Badger, your first husky, who was a four-month-old puppy, did really great socializing and being in puppy training class. and how it helped you to be a, you know, a Husky mom. Can you tell us about how prepared or unprepared you felt, even with reading up on it, and how enrolling a dog in training class really helps?
You know, I was so lucky when I adopted Badger. She was a really easy dog. But it was a big lifestyle change. I knew from volunteering at the shelter how critical it was to make sure that my dog was set up for success and socially a good citizen. So we took her everywhere. We exposed her to all sorts of situations. We wanted her to be confident. We didn't want her to be afraid of loud noises. We didn't want her to be afraid of unusual situations. And the classes were great. And, you know, I still take classes to this day whenever I have a new, maybe a long-term foster dog in my family, because the classes really are there to help the humans learn and how to be consistent. And it's more about training the human than it is about training the dog, in my opinion. And, you know, training a husky is definitely a challenge, as you know. But, you know, the one most important thing that I took away from the early training was working on recall. And, you know, my dogs might never walk well on leash, and they can sit and down, but that might be the extent of it. But they all know a rock-solid recall. If they get out, I want to know that if I come, they will, if I call them, they will come to me.
Now, I know that's a hot-button topic out in the Husky community, but just can we talk just a little longer? How possible is it to actually, train these dogs for recall?
Well, with a little bit of a prayer. Yeah, you know, we work on it, and we work on it as a game. And we play a Chase Me game, and, you know, you can Google Chase Me on YouTube, Chase Me Games on YouTube, and learn it. But they learned that that handful of times that my dogs have gotten loose from me when we've been out for walks or hikes, it's very hard, but I'll turn my back and start running the other way, and I say, chase me. Mm-hmm. And they know that really good things happen when they chase mom. And so usually they'll come back for that. And I've been very successful. Now, we have a 5-acre dog park here in Omaha, and I'm able to call my Jambalaya. She's probably maybe the most trainable of all my huskies, but I can call her from one end to the other regardless of who she's playing with and what she's doing, and she will come at a dead run and sit at my feet.
That's wonderful. I mean, it's good to have that as a backup in case they ever get out, you know. And again, it's good to know you can start this, not necessarily, they don't have to necessarily be a puppy, but it's lots of time and work to be put into it. Plus, you have an enclosed park that you're working with them in. You know, so I think it's a great thing to teach them, even hopefully if they get out, you have this backup plan.
Right.
You know,
It doesn't always work, you know. I mean, you know the breed, and you know their prey drive and their desire to run. But
yeah, they could be doing great, and all of a sudden they see that squirrel.
I know.
I have. I probably have two that I would say. I say I'm confident. Again, I never do let them off leash except here on my own property. But I'm confident two would come back. Gibson would just give up because he's my big woolly guy with a medical history. So I think he would just poop out halfway down the road and just wait for mom to come pick him up. Wolfie's too attached to me, so he would do it for a little bit, and I think he'd try to find me. And the other two, they will go to the sunset, you know. So they're the type that, you know, they'll just keep running. And Chloe, she just was going to follow, and then she's going to get herself lost. So, you know, it is interesting to see across the breed. You almost can detect the ones that will be more successful at that. But, you know, you're a professional in here, and I know Robert, you know, same thing with his training. And I just like to put out there that newbie parents really should definitely just keep in mind, keep them on leash, and really, like Jackie says, go through a lot of training in enclosed areas. It's definitely not something to try inexperienced, but it's great to have for that backup plan. I mean, it's just nice to know because, you know, they always do. At some point, they manage to get out. And I just think that's a great peace of mind to be able to have that. And, again, that's called Chase Me. you said? And then
Chase
they can
me.
Look that
Chase
up?
Chase Me Game. Mm-hmm.
Chase Me Game. All right. That's a great, great tip. Now, Jackie, you've talked about how in the first several months of Tayshia being with your family, it wasn't all rosy. Mm. Let's talk a little bit about the challenges of adding a third female to your family, and how did you resolve them?
Oh, gosh. You know, it was awful. Tayshia's social skills weren't great. And my youngest, Jambalaya, her and Tayshia would fight. And it wasn't just noise. I mean, it was the prying of the jaws apart to get them to separate. And it was terrifying. It was heartbreaking. And, of course, the advice we were given, rather than teaching us how to manage this, was just to euthanize Tayshia. And perhaps I might need to euthanize Jambalaya. It was ridiculous. So, you know, my husband and I talked about it. We committed to taking her into our family, and that meant that if we needed to keep them separate, we would keep them separate. But that's not ultimately what we wanted. And so I had spent a lot of time talking to Paige from Tales of the Tundra, and she just spent hours on the phone with me. But one of the things that she had me do was to get them to work together. And we did that initially, and we would just go out on brisk walks, and that we made it their job. And so walking together became an okay thing for them because they were working. They had a job to do. They needed to walk and be good citizens. And so we looked for opportunities to show them that good things happen when they were together. It took a lot of time and patience, but the most part they learned to accept each other. I don't know that they ever, you know, really liked each other, but, you know, we felt comfortable, you know, probably within about a year leaving the two of them in a room together without, you know, worrying about it.
So good to hear that, you know, this happens, because I know sometimes, you know, families do adopt in or bring in another dog and they have issues, and, you know, it can be very disheartening, very worrisome. So it's really encouraging and inspirational to hear that these things can be worked out. When integrating a new husky into an already established dog home, what are some good pointers that you can share to help ease that transition?
You know, I think we've probably had several, I don't know, 300 fosters come through our house since we started the rescue, at least spending one night. And the important thing that I think it's important to remember is to just be patient and don't rush. Keep the energy as calm as possible for the first few days. You know, don't go out for ice cream and to the baseball game and to PetSmart and have the neighbors over, you know, when you bring a new dog home. You know, keep the energy calm. Let them settle in. And I think it's important that, and we try to educate our adopters about just setting accurate expectations. You know, when somebody adopts or has a puppy and brings a puppy home, you expect that you're going to have accidents and mishaps. But as humans, we kind of expect that an adult dog is going to already know these things and know exactly what we want. But they don't necessarily. They still have to be taught, and the same amount of time and work needs to go into integrating an adult dog as would a puppy. And so I always like to make sure that everyone has realistic expectations, that their new dog is going to require time and training and work. And one thing I love to do with new foster dogs, and I suggest to new owners, is to hand feed them and do this along with obedience. So, you know, ask them to sit and then feed them a handful of kibble, or ask for a down or whatever the dog knows how to do, and then reward them with a handful of kibble. It teaches them so many good things. Good things come from the human hand. It means that we're doing about 10 minutes of obedience every day, which is great. The dog learns that he needs to work for his food, and it helps establish a really good bond.
Those are really, really great tips. Now, for those who are just tuning in, this is a Side Vibe on Dog Works Radio, and we're chatting with Jackie Roach, president and founder of Tayshia Blue Siberian Husky and Malamute Rescue, and that's based in Nebraska. You can follow Tayshia Blue on Facebook of the same name, or check out their website at www.tayshiablue.com, and that's TaysiaBlue.com. Now, Jackie, when you began, you were a Siberian Husky rescue, and then over the past couple of years, you added Malamutes. What prompted you to expand the rescue to include the Husky's beautiful cousin?
Well, you know, one day I received a call. A friend of mine who works for Best Friends Animal Society reached out to me and asked if Keisha Blue would be willing to help by taking some of the Malamutes that had been seized from a really bad breeder situation in Montana. The dogs had been waiting for emancipation from the court for about a year, and they'd be ready to go to rescue and to be adopted. So I said, yes, you know, we could take maybe four or five. And they were pretty shy and unsocialized, and I thought they'd be in rescue for a while. Well, we received four in January of 2013, and they were all adopted by early February. So
wow,
they asked us to take some more. So we took another three, plus then I had adopted Betty from them. And during this time, we worked really closely with the Alaskan Malamute Assistance League, and then they reached back out to us. Apparently, we were adopting out Malamutes pretty fast, and they asked us if we would like to be an affiliate rescue and take on Malamutes. And so our leadership met, and we decided that, yes, we would. And I, you know, fast forward a year, and my husband, Mike, is now president of the Alaska Malamute Assistance League. So he's truly jumped in with both feet to help that breed.
Wow, that's wonderful. Now, many folks sometimes confuse the two breeds, especially a woolly Siberian
mm-hmm.
Husky and a Mal. And I know we both have woollies. What are the basic physical differences between a Siberian Husky and Malamutes for the untrained eye?
Well, you know, they are so different, and it is hard sometimes for people to tell them apart. Physically, the Malamute is generally bigger and broader. I like to think of them more as like the Clydesdale horse,
mm-hmm.
and the Siberian Husky as a racehorse. A Mack truck versus a sports car.
mm-hmm.
Malamutes always have brown eyes. If they have blue eyes, then they're at least a Siberian Husky mix. Their ears are further apart on their heads, and they sit down a little further, and they're slightly rounder. Usually, like a Siberian Husky should have room for a couple fingers between their ears, and a Malamute, I like to say, has room for a party hat.
These are great. Now, with regards to temperament, how do these two breeds compare and differ?
Well, you know what? I'm still learning that. They seem to be a lot more human-focused versus the Siberian who likes to be with other dogs in general. I always think that, and I always believe that Siberians do better in pairs or multiples, where a Malamute might prefer to be the one and only. They can sometimes be pretty challenging to integrate into a house with other dogs. I've seen a lot of same gender issues, female to female issues or male to male issues. And oh my gosh, they can be stubborn. I thought Huskies were stubborn. These guys wrote the book on it.
More stubborn than Huskies. Wow.
Well, and maybe, you know, when they just refuse to do something, they're a little bit bigger and harder to make it work. You know, and I have one, and I really work hard to keep her socialized and work on her training. She can be kind of a little bit of a jerk with the other dogs, and so we work on that all the time. But we're still learning about the breed, and we rely on others from the Malamute world all the time. You know, they are like Husky. They are absolutely not for an inexperienced dog owner, neither
mm-hmm.
breed.
Now, many folks fall in love with these two breeds because of their beauty without doing any homework first and, you know, into their nature, their needs and habits. And, I mean, I don't have to tell you, you see this all the time. Can you give some of your top important points about these two breeds to know prior to someone welcoming them into the family or for them to at least think about before they do?
Sure. You know, well, they require work, and training is going to be a challenge. They are not easy dogs to train. They need exercise, but they need their brains to be tired as much as they need to wear out physically. So involve them in your life. They are not dogs that are content to just wait for you when you're done with all your other activities. They want to be with you. You know, so enrich their lives. They shouldn't just be decoration. Challenge them. Always take training classes, learn new things, do tracking, agility, scootering, hiking, all those kinds of things, but involve them.
Now, as ridiculous as it is, both of these breeds have made it on various, and I say this lightly with quote fingers, dangerous breed so-called lists. You know, we've seen them. They're out there. I don't know who they are that put them together, and we here at Five Sides have even petitioned against one that had gone up a year ago, and it was revised, and they did pull the two down. We did a little campaign, you know, showing pictures of these breeds with families and, you know, said, this is ridiculous. Where did you get your information? In your opinion, what is the biggest misconception about Huskies and Malamutes that winds up with them being on such crazy lists?
Well, you know, this is my theory, and it's only my theory, but I think these lists come from potentially based on insurance claims.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think about that, they put a list of dog breeds potentially that might have a high propensity for claims. Now, a claim can be a dog bite, or a claim can also be property damage. So I don't think it would surprise anyone to see a Husky or Malamute on a list for potential property damage, right?
Right.
Or, you know, they have a high prey drive, so incidents involving small dogs or cats could be part of that. And I wonder, and this is my theory, of course, that if that doesn't just become a dangerous breed list without really understanding claims. And I only say that because, you know, you find insurance companies that seem to utilize these lists. You know, but ultimately, you know, discrimination based on ethnicity or in this case breed is just wrong. You know, breed discrimination laws in this country need to be abolished. A pit bull or a poodle can both be dangerous based on how they were raised and treated. And, you know, owners need to be accountable and not make generalizations. So don't get me started.
I know. I have to hold back sometimes on it. But again, the important fact for anyone to know, you know, when you see these dangerous lists, just go to the breed that you're interested in. We talk about the northern breeds, so Siberian Husky and Malamute. Go to the experts and the resources such as Jackie and find out everything you can about the breed and what, you know, what things they had that maybe would or would not work in your family. And just don't take these, quote, lists, you know, at face value and do your own homework and, you know, go meet some in a rescue and talk to the experts and really find out, you know, how this dog can or cannot fit into your family. Now, Jackie, foster families are so key to a rescue success. What do you look for in a foster family and how can someone apply to be one for Tasia Blue?
You know, foster families save two lives. Each time somebody agrees to take a dog into their home, they save the dog that they're fostering, and they also make room in that shelter for another dog to be saved. So in my book, they are heroes, absolutely. They save lives. It's as simple as that. We have different levels of foster families at Tasia Blue. If someone's thinking about adopting a Husky or they just want to kind of test it out a little bit, we have you know, some of those folks. I would love it if somebody came to me and said that they've had 20 years of Husky experience and they're a certified dog trainer and they want to foster for us. But that's not always the case. And ultimately, we want to save as many lives as possible. So we want somebody who's willing to love and safely care for a dog in their home. We have some basic volunteer guidelines that we want our foster volunteers to follow. Nothing crazy, but we just like things to be very consistent in terms of the care and the training. We provide food and vet expenses. We provide a crate, and we ask that they work with us to get the dogs to events or to home visits, and to get them ready to be adopted. Right now, we're working on our foster application online, but someone could just simply contact us through our website at tasiablue.com, and we can get the ball rolling.
Now, in order to adopt from Tasia, prospective parents need to live within a 3-hour radius of Omaha. Can you just quickly walk us through the adoption process?
Sure. And you know what? We use that 3-hour radius as a guideline. It's not fixed in stone. We have made exceptions outside that bubble. But we put that in place so we can provide resources to the families. We want to be able to be there to help. And so that's kind of why it's there. But we have an online application process. And so somebody would fill out the online application form and submit it. And then our adoption team goes to work. We have a team of volunteers that will contact references, another team that will contact the applicant. All this happens usually within a couple days. You know, a lot of people will fall in love with a photo on the website, but we want to make sure that we're matching a dog's personality with what the applicant is looking for from a new pet. So we go over that with the applicant when we talk to them on the phone, and then an adoption counselor is assigned. You know, as long as we hear back from the references, you know, most applications are processed and approved within a few days, and then we'll usually schedule a home visit on the weekend. We typically bring two or three dogs to meet the family. We make sure that their home is ready for a dog, that the, you know, there's nothing with the fence that needs to be repaired or, you know, or concerns that we have. We want to make sure that the home, you know, that the dog's going to be living in the home and not outside and that sort of thing. And then hopefully with those couple dogs that we've brought to meet the family, hopefully we've made a match, and if not, we just go back to the drawing board and we'll come back with more dogs at another date.
Now, since Tasia Blue is a nonprofit organization, you really do rely on donations and fundraising to aid in the day-to-day operations. Over on your website, there are links to shopping through Amazon Smile, which benefits your rescue. Folks can make direct donations. You have a Tasia Blue Vineyards wine fundraiser where all the proceeds benefit the rescue. And I have to say, I've purchased several bottles, and the bottles are so cute with the husky. I really wanted the bottles, but the wine's pretty good, too. Are they Tasia Blue huskies on those labels? By any chance?
Oh, they absolutely are. We have Zeus, Ziva the Diva, Abby, Balto, Maddie, and Tasia Blue herself are on the wine bottles.
They're adorable. I have them in my dining room. So if folks even want to go and check that out, the wine is really good, but you are going to want to keep the bottles. They make great vases.
Yes.
You also have an online store, and if folks order their dog food through Chewy.com, Chewy will donate $20 to Tasia Blue,
yep,
for each purchase. And additionally, you have an upcoming Golf for Paws fundraiser event on June 29th. Can you tell us about the event, where it is, how folks can participate, you know, sponsorship opportunities, and how that helps rescue your huskies and Malamutes?
Absolutely. So we look at these events as twofold, as a way to generate donations and funds for the rescue, but also to get the word out that Tasia Blue exists and that we have these wonderful dogs that are available for adoption. And so we're super excited about the golf tournament. This will be our first ever golf tournament. There's still time to sign up. We still have some foursomes open. To do a sponsorship, it's starting to get a little late for that, but I think we can still accommodate. We'll have a raffle and a dinner, and if you don't like to golf, you can sign up just for the dinner. All proceeds go to the rescue and help us cover all the over and above medical expenses of the dogs in our care.
That's wonderful. And today you also have an event going on for Father's Day, a meet and greet, right? That's kind of happening now, I think. So where is that and how long is that going on for?
Today we are at the Green Spot, which is a dog health food store here in Omaha. And we'll be there from 1 o'clock to 3 o'clock Central Standard Time. So that's how my husband is spending his Father's Day, is getting that all set up.
What a great dad.
Yeah, isn't he great?
Yes. Now, your website has lots of valuable resources and information on huskies and Malamutes, tips, training and handling information, upcoming events, and available dogs. Let's just talk about the positive benefits of adopting a dog. What valuable lessons does adopting and caring for one help children to learn?
You know what? We live in such a throwaway society. Committing mm-hmm. to a pet teaches kids about the cycle of life and of friendship and how to cope. It's a great opportunity to teach them compassion and have a conversation about having patience, giving second chances. It teaches all of us the value of life. You know, these dogs are, they need second chances, and we all need second chances in life.
Right. Now, there are some very important things for prospective first-time Husky owners to know, and I'm just going to kind of go through this little list that I've compiled being a fellow Husky mom. They need to be aware of the escape artist, the power digger, the fence scaler, the massive shedder, the talented howler, the I'm smarter than you attitude, the husky, the furniture toys, and anything in my reach destroyer, the small prey chaser, and sometimes killer, the exercise and zoomies nut, and the never leave me off leash runner for most of us. Which all brings me to talk about husky-proofing the house and yard. We know they're notorious Houdini huskies, and they've earned that title very easily, as they can dig, scale, jump, squeeze through most typical fencing with the greatest of ease. And I know we all joke here that we have four, five sides. When I have friends come over and they look at my yard, we have railroad ties with metal stakes driven into the ground with shale dropped around the fence. We have like six-foot wooden privacy fences that are vertical, so they can't get any kind of footing. But, you know, it is so important, the yard containment, to keep huskies safe. I think there's a video that's going viral right now about a husky from, I think one of the rescues actually posted it, where there's a metal gate, and this husky can actually get his head through and manage to squeeze the body through. And their philosophy is if the head gets through, the body's following. But what types of fencing do you recommend, and what type of backyard enclosure would you want your potential fosters and adopters, you know, to have to help ensure that these Houdini dogs stay put?
Well, I'd love maybe an 8-foot concrete, you know,
wall
barrier. But you know what? I love to see 6-foot privacy fences. You know, that's a good start. They will dig, and so we'll talk about, you know, areas that might be opportunities for digging. You know, we'll suggest landscaping and things that somebody can do. And, you know, everybody's done the railroad ties or the
concrete
patio
footing.
Pavers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But you know what? We have dogs that are okay with chain link. And we even have some dogs that are okay with a 4-foot fence. I've got two little, they're not little, two blind Malamute puppies that are about 8 months old. And they'll do fine in a 4-foot fence environment, you know. So, you know, we prefer the 6-foot privacy fence, but, you know, we will, you know, take each applicant and each dog's needs and work to find a match as best we can.
And I think a lot, too, I mean, wouldn't you agree would depend, too, because a lot of homes have, you know, are dual working homes. So, you know, a lot of times they can maybe pop in, check on the dog during the day or, you know, so whether it's inside the home or outside the home, I think also determines someone's working at the home all the time and they're with the dog all the time. I'm sure maybe then they can work with them for something different, you know, and multiple dogs. Sometimes our crazy one is Bandit, and she can get them all. We call her the flying monkey because she can leap off the deck. I don't think her feet ever touch the ground. She caught a squirrel on the top of our 6-foot fence in midair, and I never did see her feet hit the ground from the deck. And, you know, then all of a sudden we have Chloe who bebops along and thinks, that looks like a lot of fun, and she can't do it at all. So, I think that this is something, too, that, you know, if they're adopting, talk to the rescues, talk to you, and, you know, see, you know, learn what the dog's nature is and really work with them. But, you know, the containment is important, and, you know, as well as inside the house, too. A lot of people will leave and want to know why the dogs rip up their couch, and they have been known to do that.
Absolutely.
You know, we use children's gates in our house, and when I say children's gates, they are four and a half foot tall metal gates, and I have to get the ones that have the trick safety latch because that one he has even learned how to open. There is not a door or a gate that Gibson can't open. And to watch him do it's pretty funny. I mean, he really thinks about it. He watches me, and then he'll lay down, and he'll take his paw, and he'll take that. He has a big paw because he's a woolly, and he'll just learn how to pop that gate and the locks. And he's gone out my back door, which is a doorknob. I'll be in the living room, and I'll hear the back door open, and I'll be like, who's coming in? It's Gibson. Because he now knows how to get himself back in the house as well. So, you know, yeah, so they are very, very clever. So, you know, again, you know, the containment's very important. Some people, we used to have their own bedroom, and they each had their own kennel with the doors open, and they were all crate trained, and they loved it. You know, now they're all grown up now, so only two of them actually well, actually just one now, she'll go in there. But they all kind of, you know, they've all, they're really great, you know, so they kind of meander around here. Now, for those who are just tuning in, this is the Side Vibe on Dog Works Radio, and we're chatting with Jackie Roach, president and founder of Tasia Blue Siberian Husky and Malamute Rescue, and that's in Nebraska. You can follow Tasia Blue on Facebook of the same name, or check out their informative website at www.tasiablue.com. That's TASIABLUE.com. Now, Jackie, education is so key, and many newbie parents just don't comprehend the stealthy intelligence, the endurance, and the play of a husky. What is the one thing you keep seeing over and over again that you hope to one day have folks understand about the Siberian Husky breed?
You know, they want to be with you. They want, you know, they need their lives enriched. Take them on walks. Give them something to dream about. We have a saying that a tired husky is a very good thing and a bored husky is a very dangerous thing. But, you know, don't expect perfection. You know, work with them. Teach them what you want from them. They don't speak English, so don't expect them to understand. Train with positivity and rewards. They're intelligent dogs, and they're going to think for themselves. So life with a husky will be messy. They won't be perfect, but they will always love you. But train, train, train.
Right. Now, there seems to be such an epidemic of Siberian Huskies being dropped off at animal control and shelters, and I don't, you know, I'm not in the Malamute world, so I don't know if it's the same there, but, and this is all over, what do you think we can, as a community of dog lovers, do to help cut down on these numbers?
Wow. You know, breed education is the key. I think way too many people see Siberian Husky puppies and they think they're cute and adorable, and without thinking about these cute little puppies will one day soon be a dog, and without proper training and supervision and confinement will grow into a crazy adolescent. And so educating these folks on the breed and what to expect is very important. I also think it's important to talk about rescue as an alternative to buying a husky. A puppy. You know, I talk to a lot of people who still don't realize that you can find a purebred dog at a shelter or through a rescue group, and they're not there because they're bad dogs. They're there because they escaped and you know, potentially, or, you know, were brought in as a stray and no one ever claimed them. You know, but with a rescue dog, an adopter is going to know in advance a little bit about what they're going to get. You know, and lastly, and I, this is probably not going to make me overly popular, but we as a rescue community need to give people a chance. Not all applicants are going to be perfect, but they might be. There might be a perfect match for a particular dog. And we have to trust in our system to educate those applicants and to do our due diligence and follow up and make sure things are going okay. But let's stop working really hard to find reasons to deny applications. You know, when I got my first husky, I would have been denied by most rescue groups. My fence was inadequate. I had cats. I had no dog experience. And if I wouldn't have had Badger, my first husky, Tasia Blue would have perished in the shelter and I'd be at the movies this afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think for us at Tasia Blue, and based on the numbers that we get, I know how many we need to move through on a monthly basis in order to continue to pull the dogs from the shelters that we work with and that we help. You know, and sometimes it's a matter of, you know, an applicant, you know, maybe hasn't given their heart guard preventative. Well, maybe they didn't know they needed to.
Mm-hmm.
So let's use this as an opportunity to educate, not as an opportunity to deny.
Excellent.
And then follow up and do the due diligence. So.
Right, because now that's part of what you do when you have adoptable dogs as well, right? I imagine you go out there and you double check with them and you keep up with the families and find out how the dogs are doing afterwards.
Yes, absolutely.
See, and education, again, is key. So I think that's really great. I'm with you 100% on that one. Now, some of the dogs that come into your rescue must have had some bad experiences from their former lives, because some of them have been lost, some of them have been abandoned, some of them have been abused. And, you know, when they arrive, they don't come with, you know, a notebook that says what happened to them, which would be great if they did, but I know it can be quite a challenge. Can you talk a little about how the rehabilitation process and how difficult or easy is it to re-socialize them with people and other dogs?
Yeah, you know, when we get dogs, we usually have a pretty good indication from the shelter staff as to what to expect personality-wise. Some of our shelter contacts will even send us behavior test videos, and that helps us determine what foster might be a good fit. We always make sure that they get to the veterinarian for an exam and take care of vaccination protocol and get them heartworm tested and spayed and neutered if they need it. And then we start observing and working with the dogs. You know, a lot of times our resident dogs will do a lot of the work for us. You know, sometimes they come in and they're terrified of people, but they will get a sense of confidence from being with the other dogs. We brought in a dog into my house to foster a couple months ago, and she was so shut down and terrified that my husband had to pick her up and carry her outside and then back in the house. And he did that for 8 days before she would even walk. But she gained confidence by watching my pack and learning how to play. And now she's pretty much ready for a home.
That's wonderful.
You know, so it's patience. And, you know, sometimes it takes longer. We've had dogs that have been in rescue for 18 months, you know, and it just takes time, and it takes the right applicant.
Wow, I can't even believe our hour has gone by so quick, and I'm just going to ask you one more question, and I'll ask Robert if, you know, Robert, is there anything you want to ask Jackie before we get ready to wrap up?
Yes, I do have one question, but go ahead.
Jackie, how would you describe the joy of seeing one of your adoptable dogs, who you were able to save from death, and see them adopted and living a wonderful life with, you know, a forever family, or being in, you know, one of the wonderful foster homes?
Well, there's nothing in the world like it. It makes all the stress, the hours, all the work, the tears worth it. Rescue is hard work. It's draining. At times it's devastating. It's disheartening. And those adoption moments or those breakthrough moments are what we live for.
Oh, that's wonderful. I mean, I love sharing. I call them happy husky ending, new beginning stories,
mm-hmm.
and I love sharing them. And, you know, please feel free to share them with me, because I love getting them out there so folks can see it. And, you know, it's so heartwarming. Robert, you had a question?
Yes, I have one question in regards to what you tell your adoptees, especially brand new folks that have never had dogs, about the cost of owning a dog, and in particular, the very expensive vet expenses that can come up, obviously very suddenly. How do you explain that to those new dog owners, and what is the decision that is based on that?
Well, you know, that's a great question, actually, and we include on our application, it's a free form box that they fill out. And so we usually will have a pretty good idea of what the applicant is expecting to spend per year in vet expenses. We spend a lot of time talking about nutritional, you know, the value of nutritional-based foods. And that's part of our education process and making sure that, you know, people understand the, you know, the cost of food and the preventatives, but planning for at a minimum of maybe $1,500 a year annually on potentially vet expenses on top of the food and preventatives and everything else that goes with it.
Right. And, you know, and I'm sure Dorothy could talk for hours about knee problems with dogs and how much those types of operations cost. And so many people, I would say the vast majority, just don't have that type of money in savings. And I bring that up as a dog trainer. I hear all the time people say, you know, my dog has this or that and we can't keep her because the vet expenses are so expensive. and then they surrender to a shelter or a rescue or whatever. And in today's society, unfortunately, that's a cause of concern with dog ownership, and I try to do whatever I can to educate folks on that.
I actually just want to comment, and again, this is just in my humble opinion, having five, as you said, I've had three of them go through, two went through double surgeries on their CCLs. Gibson also has epilepsy, thyroid issue. You know, you don't know this going in, but I just want to say, and this has always been our philosophy, when we take a dog in, they're part of our family. You don't always know
right.
when someone's going to get sick. You don't always know when someone is going to need something. And for me, I wouldn't make the decision to bring a dog into my house. I already know that things can pop up. You know, I feed them. Everybody feeds them whatever they feel is the best for them. You know, I'm not going to tell someone you should feed this or feed that. But I do adopt a different type of healthy eating program here because of Gibson. There are different triggers, and all my dogs get it. All my dogs are on the supplements. And, you know, people have different ranges. But my point is I would hope and that people would, when they take on this responsibility, you just never know what the future holds. So I think that they need to just hopefully make the commitment that when a dog comes into their family, it's the same as a family member. This is part of your family. You're committed. You hope and pray the dog will stay healthy. But if they have a need, don't just drop them off. You know, talk to your vet. There are different programs that are out there that possibly could offer assistance. I know with epilepsy, some folks may not be able to afford the epilepsy medication. There's the Wally Foundation. They will possibly help with financial assistance for dogs who have idiopathic epilepsy and help them with the medication. And that's just one illness in one foundation. So, you know, sometimes vets may have a program through their veterinarian office. So they really, if something comes up and it gets difficult, you know, inquire, find out. Don't bring the dog, you know, and drop them off at a shelter, at an already overcrowded shelter. And also, too, a lot of people today do auctions online. I mean, you know, you can put a variety of different things. Maybe you have a service. Maybe you're a photographer. Maybe you do artwork. And auction off a couple pieces. People are always very willing to help. And I see participation in auctions are amazing. And, you know, that's just another way that could help finance something that may come up. You know, I know some people do GoFundMes, and I'm very, very careful about those because I only work really with rescues that verify that these are true issues because, again, with the internet, you don't always know who you're dealing with. So I only take that on recommendation from rescue folks that they're legitimate GoFundMes. But there are a whole variety of ways that, you know, someone could help, you know, bring in funding for that dog. And that's just me on my box. Jackie, I want to thank you so much for joining us here today on the Side Vibe. And I know Tay is smiling down at you, enjoying watching you continue on with her legacy, you know, of saving other endangered huskies and malamutes and giving them a life filled with love and family. And, you know, I'm so pleased because of Tay, I got to meet you online. And, you know, you do some fantastic work there, you and your husband both. So thank you very much for being our guest today.
Thank you for having me, Dorothy.
And thank you so much for what you do for the huskies and the malamutes in need. All right, everybody, have a great Father's Day, and we'll talk to you next month.
All right, Dorothy.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye
guys.
Now.
We aren't going to have any out music since we are having some internet issues. So, Dorothy, take care. We'll talk next month, okay?
Okay, I thought you were going to ask me to sing, and then we were going to scare all our listeners away.
Bye-bye,
everybody.
Have a good weekend, and happy Father's Day to everybody out there. Goodbye.